Good morning. Welcome. Because of all that's been going on in our lives, I thought that speaking about fear and hope and now grief and loss might be helpful, particularly in terms of our practice. So today's talk is about grief, but a little disclaimer. As various things came up and time factors entered into it, and then Faye handed me an article that really sums up grief in terms of what we're going through, my talk has changed several times. So what I'm going to do is I want to try and just set out very briefly, because grief is a very broad subject with many different views, just a brief discussion of it, particularly in relation to how we as Zen Buddhists perceive the world. So I want to start out, anybody familiar, I know you probably are, Carol, with the poet Rengetsu, a Buddhist nun. You know, she was I think she produced 50,000 works of art, most of which were pottery work. And in the pottery that she did, there was a haiku or a poem that she had written. So this is her poem, a short poem. It's called Ice in the Mountain Well. Yesterday, I shattered the ice to draw water. No matter. This morning, frozen, just as solid. So that's an expression of impermanence. And part of grieving, part of impermanence, you cannot accept. We talk about impermanence, we have to talk about grieving. I will write this down, but let me see if I can explain it. In Buddhism, we view impermanence as a fact of life, right? This is just the way it is, as much as we may want it to be otherwise. And we've talked about this before, but nothing stays still. Nothing remains the same. And basically, there's nothing we can do about that. That's the fact of life. And when we have difficulty with impermanence, most of the time Buddhism will refer to when we can't accept things as they've changed, right? We cling to the way they were. That's referred to as suffering. Now I look at this slightly differently. I don't say that's not suffering. And as I've talked to you before just recently, that suffering is based on the stories that we tell ourselves about the pain that we're in, right? If things change and we wanted them to be otherwise, there's pain. But if we make up a story about that pain, it's not fair. How can this person change? It's not fair. Don't they care about me? Okay, so now that story is creating suffering. It's not just accepting the pain of what happened. We're creating a story or clinging to the old way that changes pain into suffering. So as I've said many times, suffering is what we make up about the pain that we're in. Now, it doesn't mean, you know, we have this, I think what happens with Zen is we have this view that's transported down through history. And a classic image is of a Zen master sitting with perfect composure, waiting for the samurai to chop off his head. Now, to me, it makes a good story, but I think basically it's entirely unrealistic for most of us, no matter how advanced our practice may be. But we have those images, and I think those images can settle into us and communicate to us if we have difficulty with impermanence, that somehow we are weak, that our practice is not strong enough because we can't receive it like one of these old teachers out of Zen. So I think it's important to see the difference between pain and suffering. But when things change, if we suffer a loss or a disconnection, the normal human response to that experience is to grieve. And that grief process is expressed in many ways, which I'll talk about in a little bit. That grief process is something that we go through to help us come to terms with impermanence, right? It's not just a light switch. You know, things change. Okay. No, there is a human response to that change for a variety of reasons. And the one that comes to mind is, and most of you know this, it's called, these are the psychological technical words, it's called separation and individuation. A child is born from a mother, and there's a bond to the mother, and that bond continues until a certain age where the assignment, the psychological and biological assignment for the child is to separate and become an individual on their own. Now, for both parties, that separation, that end of things the way they were, is very hard. And many times there's grieving. But that grieving is a necessary part of that separation. Because if we grieve and we grieve whole, wholly, completely, then we accept that change. It helps us adapt to that change. Right. For most people, it's not, you know, a snap of the fingers. Okay, see you. Have a good time in college. It's much more subtle than that, and it's much deeper than that. So, yes, there's impermanence. And, yes, when things change, it causes pain. But it doesn't mean that we're suffering. It doesn't mean that we're not accepting the change, which it can mean. But it may also simply mean that we're going through the process of adapting to that change, and hopefully in a healthy way. So let me move on from there. A normal part of this coming to terms with a loss, with a change, and it's really a loss of the way things were, and you know, the way we preferred them. And so if we hold on to our desire for things to be permanent, there's many things that will come out of this, many emotions and struggles. And one of them may be a tremendous amount of anger. We may get depressed. We may get sick. We may feel isolated. We may become non-communicative, and so on. And these emotions arise out of the fact that we have difficulty, the loss or the change. Now, we can work with these things and come to terms with the loss, or we can stay stuck and suffer. And that's what suffering is. At least that's how I see it. I think what happens is when you read in the Buddhist literature, generally the word pain doesn't come up. This distinction isn't made. Suffering is sort of a generic word, and I think it's misleading. That's why I go through all this to explain it. So as I've just said, if we learn to accept impermanence, we may experience a pain of loss. But the thing is, we'll be much less encumbered by clinging and negative self-talk if we learn to accept impermanence. If we've worked with impermanence and we've made it part of our practice, it will make it less likely that we will create suffering for ourselves. And there's a metaphor for living our lives when it's described as how water moves and lives, right? Water, it's in a sense an alive thing, but if you watch water as it moves down the stream, it conforms to the bend in the stream. It goes around rocks. It's flexible. It rolls or it moves with life itself. It doesn't resist life itself. And that's one of the things that we learn through sitting, to be more fluid, to be more flexible. And that part of practice helps us deal with loss, right? We move more with the loss, and it makes us more flexible in going through the grief process. It helps us. So just to repeat, impermanence and loss are not in opposition with each other. Impermanence and loss go together, right? There's no other way to look at it. And the assignment becomes, how do we deal with the loss that arises out of the fact that the world is impermanent? And the answer to that is, we learn to grieve. So, again, there's a variety of ways in which grief is defined. I'm going to just, for the purposes of discussion, define it in this way, a very simple definition. Grief is defined as the normal human response to a loss, a change that we didn't want. So it's a response to a loss, a change that we didn't want. To me, the most important part of this that we don't miss is that it's a human response. It's what we all do, whether we're aware of it or not, when there's some type of loss. And it doesn't have to be somebody dies, that kind of loss. There's a variety of different kinds of losses, which I'll mention a little bit more about. You know, we can lose a loved one, or we can lose a job. They're both losses, and they can both produce a response, which is grief, which helps us come to terms with the change. There are also, again, in the literature, and, you know, because of the limit of time for this talk, there's a variety of books and a variety of ways of understanding the grief process. And most of them involve various stages. But I'm not going to go into all that, but I am going to just briefly outline sort of the emotional process. And it's also important that we don't think of grief as this straight line, you know, that moves through space. We do this, we do this, we do this. It's just a general description of a process, but each of us is different, and our grief can happen in a very different way. So the emotional phases, so to speak, begin with denial, anger, great sorrow, depression, despair, confusion. And hopefully at the end of all this transformation, that we've been able to come to terms with the loss and the effect that's had on our lives. And in some way, usually through, from the Buddhist point of view, through our practice, we've been transformed by it. We've used it to become more human, more deeply emotional, and more connected to life. So those are generally the emotional phases that come up, and they can come up two at the same time in a different order than I've given. That's just generally what they are as a frame of reference for the talk. Now, I don't know how many people, I guess most of you would know this because every one of us has been through this. But just to repeat what you probably already know is there are also physiological responses to grief, which can have a big impact on how we grieve. So let me just mention some of those. We can experience numbness. We can numb out. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That may be a place that we need to go to initially come to terms with what's happening. We're just not capable yet of feeling the depth of the loss that we have. So we numb out. So it's not a bad thing. It's just a way of coping. There can be increased heart rate, headaches, fight or flight response. Right. Do we stay or do we get the hell out of town? You know, it's just overwhelming. We can't do it. I'm not going to deal with it. And we remove ourselves. Again, that's understandable. And it's not necessarily good or bad. It may be something to work with in the grief process because if you check out, you can't do the work. But in grieving, we don't use labels, good or bad. Other things like loss of appetite, decreased circulation, vision disturbances, nausea. And, you know, the list is really long. And I think, you know, most of you understand that you can't have something happen of this impact and not be disturbed physically as well as emotionally. Now, I just want to throw this in because it's tricky. But in the West, we have difficulty dealing in general with change, but also in how to respond to change. And so if we have medical issues that come up, which are provoked by change and grief, you have to be very careful because many doctors, but there are doctors who will hear what you're talking about and their reaction will be to give you medication so that you'll be relieved from the experience that you're going through to suppress the symptoms. You know, so if you're numb, which is one of the symptoms of grieving, how helpful can it be if you get a medication to get rid of the numbness? The numbness is a communication to us. If we are extremely emotional and crying and all those things that we experience, and the doctor perceives this as the person is just out of control, we have to stop this being out of control. Well, it may not be out of control. It may be a normal response. So we may not want to be medicated. It may be necessary for the grief process to not have that happen. So some wisdom has to be applied when we go for medical help. I'm not saying that it's never needed. I'm not saying that grief can't trigger some deeper psychological issues that existed before it came along. But it's just a thing to be mindful about when seeking medical help. You know, we need to be our own advocates. Now, there's a couple of other factors, one of which I just mentioned, which is that in the Western culture, there seems to be a negative bias against letting go. You know, we have to keep ourselves contained. And, as an example, this not letting go or being afraid to let go, I've mentioned this before in talks, was an obstacle for me in my own practice. You know, I would get to this place where I didn't want to let go of who I thought I was. And it was terrifying. I think I even mentioned this last week. And that was, you know, there's, a cultural basis to that. But as it turns out, letting go was the bottom line in order to benefit from practice. But letting go is not something that's easily accepted in Western culture from what I've been reading. And then there's also, for many people, a fear of emotions, particularly deep emotions, expressed emotions. You know, how many times have you heard the expression, oh, get over it? You know, it minimizes the importance of those emotions or the depth of those emotions. So just a couple of cultural factors. Another thing has to do with how these expressions of grief are accepted in Buddhism. Now, Buddhism in the West now has definitely integrated itself with the psychological culture of the West, but it can still happen where it can be perceived as weakness if the teacher or the Sangha or whoever's representing Buddhism sticks to the old view that you have to go through this in a very unemotional, stoic way with no fear and no disturbance. So again, like I mentioned before, that's another thing that we have to be careful of, that grieving and being knocked off center is not a character weakness. Again, it's just human. It's a normal part of the process. Now, one of the things that comes up, I think, for most of us in our lives is the difficulty of talking to somebody that has gone through a loss, who is grieving. It can be very uncomfortable. So there's this, you know, really deep discomfort because there's a part of us that wants to do something, that wants to help. And then there's another part of us that wants to get the hell out of there because we think that we're in over our head. And so we feel helpless as well. There's this sort of this back and forth, which is, I want to do something, but I'm terrified. I don't even know. I might make it worse by being here. So this not knowing what to say. So one of the basic guidelines of talking to somebody who's grieving, and I'm going to go a little more specifically into this in a moment, but the best advice that I ever heard was you have to learn how to listen. It's not about doing something. It's about sitting and listening and giving the person who's grieving a place to grieve. And there's sort of a humorous, I just remember this, a humorous definition of grieving, which has to do with permission to grieve, is talking about your loss over and over and over again until everybody you know is sick of hearing about it. But it's what it really is. It's permission to grieve, and that you need to talk about your grief, and you need to have somebody that's willing to listen and not necessarily give instructions about what to do. And for many aspects of my life, and I've mentioned this so many different times, but the three tenets of the Zen Peacemaker Order, I think, are perfect for dealing with somebody who has suffered a loss or ourselves who may have suffered a loss. So the first one, as we all know, is not knowing. So that means we're not entering this situation with an agenda. We're not there to do something. We're there to be silent and to listen. We don't go into it knowing, well, I know what to do. I know what I'm going to tell this person. This person needs this or this person needs that. No, it's just going to listen. And the second one is bearing witness, which means we don't turn away. We don't make a judgment and turn away. We bear witness. We are present with our open heart to the pain or even suffering that the person is going through. And so, as I said, bearing witness or listening is a great service without doing anything. And then the third, in terms of compassion, in terms of grieving, would be, of course, compassionate action. And that doesn't have to be dramatic. It could be very simple. It could be as simple as a hug. Compassionate action. Giving a person your phone number and say, listen, if you need to talk, call me. Would you like to go to lunch tomorrow? Let's go take a walk. All these simple things of just making a connection with the person are very helpful to us when we deal with somebody who suffered a loss. So not knowing, bear witness, and compassionate action, of course, all go together. You know, they're steps, but they really are all there at the same time. Now, another way to grieve, which is very important today, is to express our grief with others together. So that what I think is going to happen when Carol leads our practice circle later, we'll be able to talk about grief, particularly in terms of all the things we've been losing as we're going through this experience. You're all living it, all the variety of things that are being lost, sense of safety, sense of the comfort of the way things were. I know I'm talking to some people, when you're closer to my age, the loss of time, like how long is this going to last? I wanted to travel. I wanted to do all these things. That as a possibility has been lost. A loss of freedom, the ability to just walk out your front door and go down to the corner to pick up the newspaper. We have to wear masks. We have to wash our hands. I mean, so many different things are lost. Physical contact has been lost in a lot of ways to a degree. And so the list goes on. And one of the ways that we can come to terms with all these different losses, which are not necessarily the loss of a loved one to death, is to grieve and to grieve together. And we know from many times before that when we come together as a Sangha, that shared experience has always been very helpful. So I hope that that will be part of what is the outcome. Now, the last thing is I'm going to read something, and I think it's very good. I don't usually like to read stuff that are this long, but Faye turned me on to this, and it's from the Harvard Business Review, of all things. And so I'm just going to read it, but it's a wonderful summary of grief as we go through what's happening. So some of the HBR edit staff, Harvard Business Review staff, met virtually the other day. A screen full of faces and a scene becoming more common everywhere. We talked about the content we're commissioning in this harrowing time of a pandemic and how we can help people. We also talked about how we were feeling. One colleague mentioned that what she felt was grief. Heads nodded in all the different squares. If we can name it, perhaps we can manage it. And we turned to David Kessler for ideas on how to do that. Kessler is the world's foremost expert on grief. He co-wrote with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross on grief and grieving, finding the meaning of grief through the five stages of loss. His new book adds another stage to the process, finding meaning, the sixth stage of grief. Kessler also has worked for a decade in a three-hospital system in Los Angeles. He served on their biohazards team. His volunteer work includes being an LAPD specialist reserve for traumatic events, as well as having served on the Red Cross Disaster Services team. And he is the founder of the www.grief.com, which has over 5 million visits yearly from 167 countries. So this is the guy that should be giving the talk today. But so I'm going to read you some of the interchange between David Kessler and this interviewer. So Kessler shared his thoughts on why it's important to acknowledge the grief you may be feeling and how to manage it and how he believes we will find meaning in it. The first question by the HBR person. People are feeling any number of things right now. Is it right to call some of what they're feeling grief? Kessler, yes, and we're feeling a number of different griefs. We feel the world has changed, and it has. We know this is temporary, but it doesn't feel that way. We realize things will be different, just like going to the airport, forever different from how it was before 9/11. Things will change, and this is at the point, we're at the point where they changed. the loss of normalcy, the fear of economic toll, the loss of connection. This is hitting us and we're grieving collectively. We're not used to this kind of collective grief in the air. This is the question. You said we're feeling more than one kind of grief. Yes, we're also feeling anticipatory grief. Anticipatory grief is a feeling that we get about what the future holds when we're uncertain. Usually it centers on death. We feel it when someone gets a dire diagnosis, or when we have normal thought that arises we'll lose a parent someday. Anticipatory grief is also more broadly imagined futures. There's a storm coming. There's something bad out there. With a virus, this kind of grief is so confusing for people. Our primitive mind knows something bad has happened, but you can't see it. This breaks our sense of safety. We're feeling that loss of safety. I don't think we've collectively lost our sense of general safety like this. Individuals or as smaller groups, people have felt this. But altogether, this is new. We are grieving on a micro and macro level. Now, one of the things that, just as an aside, and I don't remember if he mentioned this, is, but from talking about hope and fear, we know that the only place to work with this stuff is in the present moment. Right? If we get lost in the past, if we get lost in the future, then we're not going to be able to do the things in the present moment that will happen when the future arrives. What can individuals do to manage all this grief? Understanding the stages of grief is a start. But whenever I talked about the stages of grief, I have to remind people that the stages aren't linear and may not happen in this order. It's not a map, but it provides some scaffolding for this unknown world. There's denial, which we say a lot of early on. This virus won't affect us. There's anger. You're making me stay home and taking away my activities. There's bargaining. Okay. If social distance for a few weeks makes everything better, okay. There's sadness. I don't know when this will end. And finally, there's acceptance. This is happening, and I have to figure out how to proceed. And that figuring out takes place in the present moment. Acceptance, as you might imagine, is where the power lies. We can find control in acceptance. I can wash my hands. I can keep a safe distance. I can learn how to work virtually. Let me ask you guys a question. I have another page and a half to read. Is this useful for me to read it?
No.
Who's saying no?
It is for me.
I'm sorry. Say that again, Court.
I find your reading helpful. That's me.
Honestly, I find the content of what Sensei is reading helpful, and I find hearing his voice helpful as well.
I think so, too.
Me, too.
All right. Well, okay. Thanks for the feedback. I just didn't want to kill you with all this. Okay. So the next question was, when we're feeling grief, there's that physical pain and the racing mind. Are there techniques to deal with that to make it less intense? Well, let's go back to anticipatory grief. Unhealthy anticipatory grief is really anxiety. And that's the feeling you're talking about. Our mind begins to show us images. My parents getting sick. See the worst scenarios. That's our minds being protective. Our goal is not to ignore these images or to try to make them go away. Your mind won't let you do that. It can be painful to try and force it. The goal is to find a balance in things you're thinking of. If you feel the worst image taking shape, make yourself think of the best image. We all get a little sick and the world continues. Not everyone I love dies. Maybe no one does because we're all taking the right steps. Neither scenario should be ignored. Neither should dominate either. Okay, so here he's saying, anticipatory grief is the mind going into the future and imagining the worst. To calm yourself, you want to come into the present. This will be familiar advice to anyone who has meditated or practiced mindfulness, but people are also surprised at how prosaic this can be. You can name 5 things in a room. There's a computer, a chair, a picture of the dog, an old rug, an old coffee mug. It's simple. Breathe. Realize in the present moment, nothing you've anticipated has happened. In this moment, you're okay. You have food. You're not sick. You use your senses and think about what they feel. The desk is hard. The blanket is soft. I can feel the breath coming into my nose. This really will work to dampen some of the pain. You can also think about letting go of what you can't control. What your neighbor is doing is out of your control. What is in your control is staying 6 feet away from them and washing your hands and focus on that. Finally, it's a good time to stock up on compassion. Everyone will have different levels of fear and grief. A coworker got very snippy with me the other day, and I thought, that's not like this person. That's how they're dealing with this. I'm seeing their fear and anxiety. So be patient. And then one particularly troubling aspect of this pandemic is the open-endedness of it. And he replies, this is a temporary state. It helps to say it. I work for 10 years in the hospital system. I've been trained for situations like this. I've also studied the 1918 flu pandemic. The precautions we're taking are the right ones. History tells us that. This is survival. We will survive. This is a time to overprotect, but not overreact. One last thing. What do you say to someone who's read all this and is still feeling overwhelmed with grief? Keep trying. There is something powerful about naming this as grief. It helps us feel what's inside of us. So many have told me this past week, I'm telling my coworkers I'm having a hard time, or I cried last night. When you name it, you feel it, and it moves through you. Emotions need motion. It's important we acknowledge what we go through. One unfortunate byproduct of the self-help movement is we're in the first generation to have feelings about our feelings. We tell ourselves things like, I feel sad, but I shouldn't feel that. Other people have it worse. We should stop at the first feeling. I feel sad. Let me go for 5 minutes to feel sad. Your work is to feel your sadness and fear and anger, whether or not someone else is feeling something. Fighting it doesn't help because your body is producing that feeling. And if we allow the feelings to happen, they'll happen in an orderly way and empower us. Then we're not victims. So anyway, I read that and I thought it might be helpful. The one thing that I know about this, and hopefully that we'll be able to share this in the practice circle, in preparing for this, a number of old griefs, losses that I had, I got stirred up. It made me realize the depth of emotion that goes along with this. For me, right in this moment, I've sort of been staying in the present, going along with what needs to be done, being compassionate to family and friends. But I think that I'm probably overlooking the feelings that I have, and I haven't touched them yet. And this is because when I looked back and I sort of re-experienced to some degree some of these profound moments, I know also that it took me a while for the reality of things to sink in. So that's sort of where I am in the grief process surrounding this. But I'm a Zen teacher, so I don't really feel this much anyway. Anyway, thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope it was helpful. Thank you.